This is Focus 580, hour number two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for our programs, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. For the past 30 years now, the cost of going to college has risen at double the rate of inflation. And to deal with that rising cost, a lot of students have been forced to borrow money. Now, at the time of graduation, the average undergraduate borrower has accrued $20,000 of student loan debt. And for graduate students, it's more than twice that. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk about the problem of student debt and how it has become increasingly difficult, and some people might say almost impossible, for people to dig themselves out from under. And our guest for the program is Alan Collinge. He's founder of a political action committee called StudentLoanJustice.org. He's done a lot of interviewing about this subject, and he has authored a book that is titled The Student Loan Scam, subtitled The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. Beacon Press is the publisher. We'll talk this morning with him about this particular issue, and of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. If you're interested in finding out more about his organization, you can link through our website, or you can just go to the website, which is www.studentloanjustice.org, and get more information there. And of course, if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out to the bookstore or to the library and look for it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people to try and keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving along. But anyone is welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Collinge, hello.
Hello. It's great to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Wait, can you say something about how over time, I mean, certainly we know over time the cost of college education has just keep on going up and up and up. Over time, though, how people have dealt with that and has the need to borrow the money as opposed to scholarships, grants, whatever, how has the mix of where people get their money coming from, where that comes from, how has that changed over time?
Yeah, that's right. You know, back about, and you hit it right on the head, tuition has been increased at about double the rate of the consumer price index for the past 30 years. And where, say, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, maybe one out of three college students ended up borrowing money for college, today, that's about two out of three. And the grant aid, the non-loan aid, has held roughly steady. So this shift in this huge increase in cost has shifted the burden effectively from, you know, the state and federal government directly onto the backs of the students. And today, the average undergraduate borrower is leaving with not $20,000, but actually $23,000 in student loans. And so it's become a truly a debt burden that no other generation has had to face.
And I was looking at some numbers about default rates, and it seemed that actually, if you go back to, well, maybe last summer before the collapse, things weren't too bad, and you can correct me, but it seemed to me like maybe it was around 5%, and that now, though, people are predicting that it's going to go up significantly, like we're headed to a rate of almost 7%, and that would be the highest default rate that we've seen maybe since the late 90s.
Yeah, that's right. The default rate has shot up by about 30 or whatever, 5 to 7, is 30 to 35% or so, which is very disturbing. But what you need to know is that this default rate that you just quoted is not the true default rate for student loans. The true lifetime default rate for student loans is approaching 1 in 3 borrowers. So 1 in 3 people that take out a college loan are likely to default on their loans. It's not this incredibly low cohort default rate, which is what you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that there are a number of explanations, and that they're the kind of things that you talk about in the book. What are the, what you would say that the basic reasons for the default rate going up so quickly, and we have so many people that maybe start out with what would have been, it may be difficult, but possible to pay back. And then you get, over time, it gets bumped up and gets bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where it's something that you almost wonder, are they ever going to be able to pay it back?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the student loan system has changed over the years to where it's gotten to the point where, frankly, the system does not care whether a student defaults on their loans or whether the loans remain in good stead, because frankly, they can make far, far more money from a loan that goes into default. So, and doing research, I learned that some very disturbing situations arose where, you know, large lenders were caught for defaulting student loans without even attempting to collect on the debt. You know, it's easier for them because there's a government guarantee behind these loans to just, you know, let the loans go into default, often without even contacting the borrower. And so it's in this environment that we're seeing this very large default rate to begin with. And in the current economic crisis, we're seeing that, unfortunately, the defaults are increasing and increasing rapidly.
Mm-hmm. And I think that also that another big issue here that is that this kind of debt is treated differently from other kinds of debt that a person might accumulate, and that makes it much more difficult to deal with that debt, and perhaps there's a lot more latitude for people who are collectors to use what we might charitably call aggressive tactics.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and this is really the key point of the book, is the fact that every standard consumer protection that we take for granted with every other type of loan is simply non-existent for student loans. There are, for all intents and purposes, no bankruptcy protections for student loans, for instance. There also are no statutes of limitations for student loans. And so you get the very sad cases where, you know, literally senior citizens are having their Social Security checks taken as a result of loans that they, frankly, usually can't even remember taking back in the 60s or 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There also is no ability to refinance a student loan after people have already graduated and consolidated their debt. Student loans are specifically exempted from the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and they also are specifically exempted from truth in lending requirements. And so every standard consumer protection that exists for credit cards and payday loans, et cetera, are just not there for student loans. And the sort of the flip side of that is that Congress has afforded the industry collection powers that are unrivaled. And, I mean, there just is no comparison in any other sort of lending industry. So, and I mentioned briefly earlier that, you know, wages garnished, income tax returns garnished, Social Security income, and even disability checks can and are garnished in order to collect on delinquent student loan debt. And people can also have their and do have their professional licenses suspended, and all manner of other sort of, you know, horrible outcomes that, you know, exist for other types of debt. You know, the standard damage to one's credit record, etc. So this has really led to a predatory lending and collection environment where, you know, the universities are sort of in the catbird seat in this, because the lenders sit back and you know, they're wanting to pile as much debt as possible onto the students. And in that sort of environment, it makes it much easier for the school to, you know, instead of doing a fundraising drive or, you know, going to their state government or finding other ways to get capital, the universities find that it's just much easier to raise tuition through the roof every year. And so it's an inflationary environment, and it's also a predatory lending and collection environment. And mm-hmm. it's really ruining lives.
I suppose that I certainly do not want to put myself into the position of defending the lenders, but I suppose that one of the things that they would say would be, you know, of any kind of borrower, the person who we would think should have the greatest potential to actually repay the loan would be somebody who is borrowing money for college. And the idea would be that then they're going to go out and they're going to have a career. Maybe they're going to go into one of the professions. They're going to have a good job. They're going to make money. And I should expect as a lender that if anybody should be able to pay me back, it's somebody like this. And for that reason, I should say I deserve to have particular kinds of protection here so that somebody doesn't get out of college, go out there and get a good job, become a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, making good income, and then just blow off this loan and when they actually do have the resources to pay. And that for me, I need some special kind of protection to make sure that I get back my investment.
Yeah, and you know, that's an extremely weak argument, but that was precisely the argument that they did use to convince Congress to ultimately, initially restrict and then ultimately remove bankruptcy protections. You know, they trotted out a few cases of people who, you know, graduated from, you know, med school or something and promptly filed for bankruptcy as a way to skate on their debt. Mm-hmm. So these stories were, you know, trumped up in the media, and this was pretty much all Congress needed to restrict and ultimately remove bankruptcy protections. But in hindsight, it turned out that back when student loans were fully dischargeable in bankruptcy, like every other type of loan, far less than 1% of federally guaranteed loans were actually discharged through bankruptcy courts. And so, you know, statistically, there really was no crisis. It was a crisis only in the imagination of the student loan industry.
Yeah. Maybe it I'm sure people would be interested in knowing how it is you got into doing this kind of work and took this on as an issue, and it indeed came out of your own personal experience of borrowing money, having the loans, and then having a real tough time paying them back. It sounds like from what I know about you is that, well, maybe you would be one of those people that would say, hey, he's a smart guy. He's an engineer. He should be able to go out there and get a good job, and there shouldn't be any problem with him paying back his loans.
Yeah, that's right. I originally borrowed $38,000 for college, and you know, I graduated and consolidated with Sallie Mae and was doing fine. When I found myself unemployed, underemployed for about a year or so after 2001, I applied for a forbearance with my lender, which should have allowed me to postpone payments for a brief amount of time while I got back on my feet financially. Well, instead of granting my forbearance, my lender put my loan into default instead. And I couldn't understand this, but there was no appeals process for defaulting a student loan. And so within 14 months, what had begun as $38,000 in loans had escalated to over $80,000 with penalties and fees. And this is despite my best efforts throughout this whole time period to negotiate a fair, you know, and reasonable payment plan for my debt. And this was really the impetus for what began as a research project for me. And what I found was just overwhelming. The pressure that was put on Congress by the lenders and the amount of money, truly, that had been thrown into congressional coffers and campaign budgets by the student loan industry was really shocking. And just the standard consumer protections that had been stripped away. And probably what is most compelling to me is the lives, the real human beings whose lives have been destroyed as a result of this truly predatory lending and collection system. You know, there's people that have come to studentloanjustice.org who have literally fled the country as a result of their student loan debt. In fact, I just got an email maybe 2 weeks ago from a fellow from Illinois who is currently out of the country, and he has no intention of coming back until the laws are changed, which, you know, gives some sanity to the student loan system. And, you know, he's got a wife and two kids back in Chicago, and he would love to come back and be with them, but because of his student loan debt, he simply can't. And I just think that that's, frankly, it's not correct in this country that something like that should have to happen as a result of student loans. It's frankly ridiculous.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Alan Michael Collins. He's somebody who has become an activist on this issue of student loans. He started the political action committee, studentloanjustice.org. And if you're interested in finding out more about that, they have a website, and That's what it is, studentloanjustice.org. You can take a look at that. He's also author of a recent book that explores this subject. It's titled The Student Loan Scam, The Most Depressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. That's the subtitle. Beacon Press is the publisher. He spends a lot of his time talking about this issue, doing a lot of interviews. He's written a lot about it. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Apparently now the Obama administration is talking about making a significant change, ending subsidized loans made by private banks. Essentially, sounds like what they're talking about is making the government the lender and getting the private banks out of it. And they say that actually would save money. And then they could take that money and put it into expanding Pell Grants. Do you think that this would be a better way to go? Would this help to take care of the problem that you're talking about?
Well, I think it's definitely a more efficient system in that it cuts out a couple of the middlemen in the process that, you know, make particularly defaulted loans so expensive for the borrowers. But, you know, I have to say, and you know, I do think it is an improvement, don't get me wrong, but the same standard consumer protections that are gone for the what's called the FFEL program are still absent in the direct loan program. So, you know, that's not a good thing, and it's setting up the stage for the same sorts of predatory lending and collection activities that are happening today. And another point that is highly disturbing is that companies like Sallie Mae and Nelnet and other student lenders that that I frankly wrote the book about, these people are all vying for the contract to perform both servicing and collection services for the direct program. So you're going to have the same rascals collecting on the debt when it goes into default, and at the same time collecting on the debt that is not in default. So the very same perverse incentives to default a loan could very easily still exist under this new program. And so, you know, while structurally it's a little bit more efficient, it looks like the same wolf in sort of different clothing if I had to be pressed to give an opinion on it.
Yeah, all right. Well, we have some callers here. Let's start in, starting with line number one, and this would be someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
Couple of questions. have you been able to break down, or do you have a breakdown of what the indebtedness goes for? As an example, you know, X percentage is for books and tuition, and the rest is to keep body and soul alive, and so on and so forth. And another question is how does our system compare here in the United States to, say, states in Europe? Once upon a time, I was under the impression that, as an example, Germany has a, you know, free or tuition-free college education, and they actually give their students a living stipend of some sort to help them along. Comment on that, please. I'm thinking that much of our problem in the States here is that we as a nation have become really cheapskates when it comes to education and are basically pressing it in the direction of only the very wealthy will ever be able to go to college as they did, say, prior to the First World or Second World War and so forth.
Yeah. That's a good point. And unfortunately, I actually don't have the breakdown as to what student loans are going towards today. But I think it's a pretty good guess that, I mean, with tuition being raised at double the rate of inflation, that increasingly student loans are going more and more towards tuition and fees and less towards, you know, books or rent or other expenses. As far as other countries are concerned, you know, there's a ton of countries where higher education is free and probably will always be free. Sweden, just to name one, and even in other countries where school isn't completely free, the cost is much less, and the schools are much more heavily subsidized by the state. And, you know, in fact, as far as consumer protections are concerned with student loans, the United States is by far and away the most sort of Orwellian, I guess, if that's a good term to use, country in terms of just a lack of consumer protections. Canada had played around with bankruptcy laws for student loans over the past 10 years or so, but they recently decided to allow again bankruptcy protections completely for student loans because they realized that it was a sort of a bad idea to play around with that. So yeah, your caller is right. We could learn a lot by looking at the models that are used elsewhere in the world. But indeed, we have as a nation become really cheapskates. And but not only that, we've set up this lending system, which, you know, much like in the home mortgage industry, has led to inflation in the cost of the good. And so I don't know if cheapskate is really the right word, rather than, you know, we just shifted the burden in the form of loans onto students who, you know, because they trust their universities and, you know, everybody is, as they grow up, has the mantra of higher education drilled into their head, you know, these students are willing to sign whatever is put in front of them. So it was really a dangerous thing that we did, and we're seeing the results unfold as we speak.
Hmm. All right. Line two is next. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm on a mobile phone, so bear with me.
Okay, you sound just fine.
I was in a similar situation in education, and rather than do the student loan thing, I chose to extend the time it took to get my education, and I paid as I went. My daughter, who has since graduated and has a job, has student loans. I guess my question is rather basic without knowing too much about the student loan program. These folks know that it's a loan. Where does the responsibility lie with the consumer who cannot pay back the loan, who doesn't pay on it for years, and all of a sudden they're faced with a garnishment of their Social Security wage? Surely there were attempts to collect the loans. And I guess my point is, it's a loan, not a grant. And these folks need to have their eyes wide open when they enter into these loan agreements, and I think they ought to pay back their loans. That's all my comment.
All right.
Yeah, you know, there's no question that when one borrows money, one is obligated to pay that money back, and personal responsibility plays into that without a doubt. But in the case of student loans, this principle of personal responsibility has been held up as a cover for corporate irresponsibility in lending to these students. You know, there was an investigation by the State Attorney General's Office of State of New York a year or two ago. Elliot Spitzer and then Mario Cuomo finished the investigation, where it was found that the universities were actually taking kickbacks from the lenders in return for the universities putting the lenders on their preferred lender lists. There were financial aid administrators that were taking cash gifts, you know, all manner of illegal incentives in order to put the lenders in a position where they were given, for all intents and purposes, a monopoly in lending the money to these kids. And let's face it, these are, you know, 18 to 20-year-old kids that we are lending the money to here. And, you know, these kids accept the word of their universities, and they trust their universities. And, you know, they will sign whatever is put in front of them, for all intents and purposes, in order to get registered for class. And, you know, these students are almost never told the incredible lack of consumer protections that are behind these loans. They're almost never told there are no bankruptcy protections, there are no statutes of limitations, there are no refinancing rights, and they are never told that in the case of a default, where in other debt situations there is some negotiation power, for student loans there is no negotiation power. And this defaulted loan will double at least, if not triple, quadruple, or perhaps far more with fees and penalties. You know, the fact that it got to the point where Sallie Mae paid a $3.4 million fine in 2000 for being caught for defaulting loans without even attempting to collect on the debt, I think that tells you right there that there is a lot of irresponsibility on the lending side of the equation. And frankly, I get a little tired of knee-jerk folks who think that they can answer the argument by simply saying, well, you borrowed the money, you have to pay it back, because these people obviously haven't done the research and obviously haven't seen the predatory environment that exists for student loans, that exists for no other loans in our country.
And is it the case, though, that, you know, some of the things that you're talking about, you're saying borrowers aren't told, that that's somewhere in the fine print?
No,
it's that
not
people
in the
aren't
fine
reading
print.
It's just that they're not, it's no, there would be no way for them to know that unless they went out and independently checked out what the situation.
That's exactly right. Nowhere in the promissory note does it say that there are no bankruptcy protections, no statutes of limitations, fair debt collection practices, etc., for student loans. It's just the promissory notes say at most that this promissory note is bound by the language contained in the Higher Education Act of 1965. So the student is on their own to research that, and even I would have a hard time realizing that there are none of the consumer protections that I mentioned if I actually went through the Higher Education Act, and because it's an extremely confusing body of law. And so, no, the students are not told, and this is why I'm calling it a scam, and this is why this is why I wrote the book.
All right. A little bit past our midpoint here. Again, I'll just very quickly introduce our guest, Alan Collinge. He's founder of the Political Action Committee, studentloanjustice.org, and they have a website, and that's what it is. You want to look at it. Also, he's authored a book. It's titled The Student Loan Scam, the subtitle, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. Beacon Press is the publisher. We have some other callers here. The number, by the way, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is Champaign County, here where we are, line 3. Hello.
Well, I'm the polar opposite of the last caller. I think it's just asinine to say that borrowing for going education is the same as borrowing for a flat screen TV or something. It's ludicrous. I think that we should, while trying to fix the student loan scandal, we should aspire to getting rid of the idea of student loans and move to a grant-based system that would be more egalitarian. I mean, really, what this current situation does is it just solidifies the lack of social mobility in this country. It really keeps the people who are well off and who can finance education without all the extra encumbrances in the places that those lines of wealth. So that's obviously a different kind of analysis. But I wanted on this specifically, and I haven't been able to clearly listen to all of it, so you might have recapitulate. You might have mentioned this. I've been following this since Senator Simon proposed taking away this cushy guaranteed loan system for the banking crooks. And I'm just wondering how if you followed that at that time, and whether the proposal that Obama has put forward will have the same fate, and if they're relatively similar, which is to have a sort of if I understand it, a national bank for student loans. Again, I think we should not go that route, but in the near term, it would at least be a bit of a solution to get these onerous terms. And get the banks out of this. I don't know how much of their bottom line is involved with this, or whether the rather limp stress test they did would have to be rerun if the banks don't get to have this largesse courtesy of the taxpayers. Anyway, I've rambled a bit. I appreciate your work, and I'll listen off the air.
Well, thank you. I agree with the point with the first point of the caller that, you know, we should really look at going back to a grant-based model for higher education. Because, I mean, your caller rightly points out that as the debt loads for the students increase, what they can do decreases. In other words, they are forced into employment that guarantees them a high income rather than, you know, say, a high public need. So a lot of lawyers that may have wanted to go into public service are prohibited from doing so. And it's not just lawyers, obviously. It's every field, you know. When you have $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 or more of student loan to contend with, then, you know, the options that you have become quite limited, and the mobility and et cetera are, suffer as a result. Now, to the second point, and I'm not completely familiar with what Senator Simon proposed, but I do know that Senator Simon's assistant, Bob Shireman, well, not his assistant, but his legislative head in educational matters, Bob Shireman, was selected by President Obama to head the not only head the transition team, but for the Department of Education, but also is currently, I'll probably get this wrong, but I believe he's Deputy Assistant Director or something at the Department of Education now. Title's probably different from what I said, but Bob Shireman is a strong proponent of the direct loan program, which takes the banks out of the lending part of the game. Although the concerns that I raised before about the persistence of the lack of consumer protections for the direct program, in addition to these Sallie Mae and other type companies that are going to be both servicing and collecting the debt, those two issues are very very important ones to me, and quite frankly, very, very disturbing.
Well, is there any, in addition to, you know, there's this talk going on now in Washington about changing the system, and there are a lot of people who are opposed because they are connected to and representing the interests of the people who are in the business. But even so, is there anybody that's saying, well, not only do I think that what the president is proposing is a good thing, but pointing to this other problem that you point to, and that is, but in addition to that, we ought to be doing these other things, and that we ought to provide consumer protection to borrowers, the people who are borrowing for college, just like we apply that protection to people who are borrowing to buy a car. I mean, is there anybody who is saying we need to do all of this?
Well, unfortunately, no. I think I'm actually the only person in the country right now that is decrying the need to return standard consumer protections to student loans. You know, Hillary Clinton actually introduced a very good bill back in 2006, which would have not only returned bankruptcy protections, but also returned refinancing rights and put 10 and 15-year repayment caps on student loans. I think that was a really good bill, but unfortunately it went nowhere, and Senator Clinton is now obviously not in Congress. Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, home state guy, also introduced legislation that would have returned bankruptcy protections, not for federally guaranteed student loans, but for private student loans. And that's a whole other area that I haven't even touched on yet. Not only are federally guaranteed student loans exempt from bankruptcy protections, mm-hmm. but so too are private student loans that are not guaranteed by the federal government. So this is like a credit card having bankruptcy protections taken away. So Dick Durbin introduced legislation, as did Representative Danny Davis, another Illinois representative, that would have returned bankruptcy protections for private student loans. Unfortunately, both of those bills were either killed or voted down on the House floor. So there are a few good guys out there, but, you know, I just haven't seen anybody in Congress really step up and call not only for a direct sort of lending model that cuts out all the for-profit incentive, but also the return of standard consumer protections. I mean, it's so important. People don't realize that student loans are the only loan in our nation's history ever to be specifically stripped of these basic consumer protections. And, you know, the results that it's having on people's lives is just overwhelming. Yeah. And with one in three borrowers winding up in default for one reason or another, often through no fault of their own, this becomes a very large problem. It's not a small problem.
And just to one quick point, and I'll get back to callers here, but and on people thinking about going to a private lender, it seems that you would say, boy, you should really think about that carefully, or at least exhaust other possibilities first.
Well, typically the interest rate associated with private loans is higher than the interest rate for federally guaranteed loans. And so just on a cost basis, I think it's important for them to look at those sorts of features of the loan. But they also, they certainly need to know that the bankruptcy protections are exempt from private loans as well as federal loans.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to cell phone line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about 5 years ago, my daughter graduated from college, and she did incur some debt. And I know she has not been able to pay back the student loan, and she says that she would really like to handle it herself, but I'm a little worried about her situation. She says she's in forbearance. How long can a person stay in forbearance?
Well, there are time limits, and there are also, there are. It's up to the lender as to how and when and for how long they grant forbearances and deferments. And so,
a subsidized direct loan.
Right. Okay. So, if she's living under a certain threshold of a certain percentage of the poverty line. Something like something like 150% above the poverty line or something, and I'd have to check that, then she can remain in forbearance or hardship deferment for a long time. But like I said, the lenders, and did you say this is a direct loan?
Yes, it's direct subsidized.
In my experience from borrowers, the direct loan program has been a lot easier to deal with than when the loan is administered through a private lender. But I think a good word of caution here is to remind you that forbearance doesn't mean that the interest is not accruing. The interest still is clicking off and, being added to the principal. And so, while you can stay in forbearance theoretically for a long time, the loan continues to grow. And I don't know what her interest rate is, but it's probably maybe somewhere around 5%, 6%, or 7%. Yeah. And so, it's a problem that's not going to go away. And so
in effect, it could double in a very short period of time.
It's certainly depending on the interest rate. It could. But I would feel a little more comfortable that the loan resides with the federal government than the loan being, sitting with Sallie Mae or Nelnet or Citibank or somebody like that.
And do you foresee if they, if the government does do something about this, do you see them grandfathering it in or just going forward?
Doing something. Well, if the federal government were to return standard consumer protections such as bankruptcy, statutes of limitations, then obviously this would have to be retroactive. They took away bankruptcy protections in a retroactive fashion, and so they would have to return it to all borrowers, not just new borrowers going forward.
What is required is pressure on our congressmen.
That's right. Yeah, this is a political challenge, and people who are interested in this subject, and there should be a whole ton of them out there. It's really incumbent upon the people to put the political pressure on the leaders. In Congress in general, but specifically on the members of both House and Senate education committees. And I'm not sure who in Illinois is on that committee currently. I know Obama was on the Senate side, but that's obviously done. But, being in Illinois, there are a lot of very important players in this game. As I mentioned, Senator Dick Durbin and Danny Davis both introduced legislation that was key and that was borrower-friendly. Arnie Duncan, also from Illinois, is now the current Secretary of Education. And, Mr. Duncan can do a lot just from where he sits administratively to allow for the, you know, if not the return of standard consumer protections, he certainly can act in a way that that imitates as if consumer protections were in place. You know, he could do a lot by way of changing the negotiation strategy of the Department of Education for defaulted loans. He could forgive interest. He could forgive penalties. He could do a lot to help borrowers out there. And so, being in the state of Illinois, I would even more strongly urge all of you out there listening who care about this issue to come to studentloanjustice.org and educate yourselves about just the basics of these issues, and see what you can do at a local level to influence both your lawmakers and perhaps even, you know, people that you know through your own networks that are, you know, working in the Department of Education or other places of influence within the federal government.
Well, I thank you for your work on it also, and it sounds like it's going to take a grassroots effort. So
it is. It is going to be a grassroots deal, and it has been about 5 years in the running now, and we've come really close to getting some very important laws put through. But I see more hope now today than I did a year ago, without question. And I think a lot of it comes down to the new president and also the new administration within the Department of Education as well.
All right, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to thank the last caller, and we'll get on to some more in just a moment. But I do also want to introduce again our guest, Alan Collinge. He's founder of the Political Action Committee, studentloanjustice.org, and that's their web address if you'd like to find out more about them. He does a lot of speaking and writing on this subject. He's the author of the book, The Student Loan Scam, and it is published by Beacon Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Up next is a caller in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling in partly in reply with a couple of earlier callers, one whom I could not agree with more, and one whom I think was speaking without knowledge of the subject. We've constructed a system in which it is imperative that a young person have a college education, or they are essentially condemned to a second-rate life. At the same time, we have made it enormously expensive to get this education. They can be completely responsible in taking out these loans. They may have every reason to suppose they can pay them, but if in the future they have illness, accident, if a child has illness, 10, 12 years later, they may find it extremely difficult to repay. And if they run into economic situations such as the what we've encountered at present, and employment isn't available, no matter how well qualified, they may again find it very difficult to repay their loans or keep paying them. I think you've hit upon part of the problem. This is enormously profitable to the banking industry, and the banking industry, I think we have seen, has no social conscience. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the comments. Anything you'd want
to... I have nothing to add to that comment. That was spot on.
All right. Then we'll go to Effingham, line number four. Hello.
Well, I'm kind of coming from the same direction as the last caller. I look at the situation as as a macrocosm rather than a microcosm, and the lifeboat. Here we are, humanity, riding in this lifeboat and having forces upon the masses that they don't understand, and insistence by the establishment, especially banks and capitalism in general, who then reach to the fascist idea that we are all on our own, we are all capable, and if you fail, it's your own fault. And there nothing could be further from the truth. The down and out nature of the capitalist paradigm now should be obvious to everyone, and some sort of real Congress around the world should look at these things. And people are suffering horrendously in the second and third world compared to us. We're living in paradise, but the same paradigm that has ripped apart all of society and all of humanity's progress is still in power. And that's, in my opinion, is what has to be changed and has to be changed fairly soon, or we're just out. You know, 92 years, a man is saying, and it'll be all over. Thank you very much.
Well, I don't know any. That's maybe a larger kind of issue than we can possibly address here. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I guess with regards to both of the previous two callers, I think it's right that private capitalism has found a way to put a price on nearly everything today, and so too with higher education. And it's a very dangerous thing when you find a way to charge for something that previously was free. I mean, it sets up a precedent where, looking forward, extrapolating, you just can't see how a society can function in the future, given that sort of tendency overgrown to, overwhelming proportions throughout the society. And the fact that higher education has had a price put on it over the past few years, and the students and their families have been forced to pay this new price, is just one example of what these callers are sort of getting at, I think.
All right, line three is next. Champagne, hello.
Yeah, hi. What I see happening, too, is that, when we had this thing that the banks are too big to fail and all that kind of stuff, back to the days of community banking, I'd worked my way through college, and actually my dad signed for me, and I got a loan, local bank, and if you had any problem, whatever. And, very fair and all that kind of thing, and then later on I did get a brief student loan. But, community banks where they're actually in it, that kind of thing to help out. The banks were there in terms of loans to help the community. What's happened now with all these big banks, they draw the money out of the community. They're in investing international and all these risky things and all that. So I don't think that was a good step either, quite frankly. And I do agree with when I worked my way through, college was not as expensive. Also, the summer jobs were more available, and I made some pretty good money almost to put myself through. So anyway, that's my comment.
Yeah, the days of being able to pay for college by working summer jobs are pretty much long gone at this point. And your caller also hits on a very important point, that the lenders today, they probably will never even see the students. There is no connection between the lenders and the borrowers, and so with no real skin in the game and no real connection to the borrowers, we can see why it's so easy and so efficient for the lenders to default a loan rather than keeping the loans in good stead, because they simply don't have any skin in the game.
All right. Next is line number one, and this is a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, good.
This is just for consideration. If someone's at the point of bankruptcy, I do know somebody who is able to discharge the interest on his student loan in bankruptcy, although not the principal. And it was something that I hadn't really considered to be a possibility until he did that. And I was wondering if you were aware of that as a possibility. I know sometimes the interest charges end up being more than the principal on the loan.
Yeah, there are interest charges and also penalty and collection costs that are put onto a loan. And the bankruptcy judge does have some leeway in playing around with the interest, but typically they have to meet this three-pronged test in order to discharge student loans in bankruptcy. They have to first of all, the borrower has to go through what's called an adversarial proceeding, which is very expensive, and 99.9% of all attorneys won't even do this because there's such a low chance of success. But they have to go through an adversarial proceeding, and then they have to prove that not only are they not currently able to pay on the loan, and that they did make good attempts to pay on the loan in the past, but it is unlikely that they will be able to pay on the loan in the future. And so this, for all intents and purposes, means that people have to be
you know, basically in a wheelchair in order to get student loan debt discharged. But yeah, the principal or, you know, the interest and some other peripheral charges may be amenable. But truly, you know, student loans should be treated, frankly, in a more forgiving fashion than other types of loans, in my view, because there is a very significant public benefit associated with student loans as opposed to, say, credit cards or other types of loans. Because there is a public benefit associated with these loans, there should be a more forgiving legal system, addressing the problems that come up with these loans. And, in fact, the reverse case is true. And so this is what's got to change.
I would agree with that because, the government is going to get back. You'd think the government and public would get back their money through taxes.
That's right. And even today, the federal government is actually making money on defaulted loans. People don't realize that for every dollar that the Department of Education pays out in default claims to lenders, it gets back every dollar of principal plus 20% on top of that in penalties and fees and collection costs. And so it's a big money-making proposition for the federal government today. And it's truly a scam. And there are so many horrible outcomes that really can't be quantified as a result of defaulting on a loan that can hurt, you know, that hurt the nation in so many ways. Certainly the public benefit that arises from the, you know, citizens being educated, that comes directly back to the U.S. Treasury in the forms of higher taxes, et cetera.
We must stop. We have one caller. I'm sorry we can't take. For people who would like to read more on the subject, you can do one of two things or both. You can look at the website that our guest, Alan Collins, began. It's the website of this organization that he founded, studentloanjustice.org. And that's the address. So go to www.studentloanjustice.org. Or you can look for his book. It's titled The Student Loan Scam, the subtitle The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. The Beacon Press is the publisher. Mr. Collins, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, David. I've had a great time.